When it comes to the seemingly endless debate over the fundamental nature of our nation, too often the conflict is reduced to two opposing and self-interested sides. I part with many progressives who paint all religious conservatives as bent on establishing a theocratic Christian nation where all are forced to yield to their interpretation of the Bible out of a raw thirst for power. No. I think many people of faith genuinely believe that our nation is in trouble and that the answers lie in the place they themselves sincerely look for answers, in their faith. I am not, however, so naive as to not recognize there are self-serving political and religious leaders eager to abuse these sincerely held beliefs for their own crass ends. In the same way, I absolutely reject the simplistic interpretation of the call from some non-believers to maintain our secular traditions and Constitution as somehow demonstrating a hatred for America and a hatred for God. Enough of that. It's noteworthy that there are many people of faith sincerely participating in this call, myself among them. Does America have enemies? Sure, we have enemies. But are they the ACLU? Americans United for Separation of Church and State? People for the American Way? Not even close. Totally different genre. An outstanding examination of the importance of maintaining our secular traditions comes in the form of a new book, In Freedom We Trust, An Atheist Guide to Religious Liberty. The authors of this very fine volume are Edward and Michael Buckner, and it's my pleasure now to welcome both Ed and Michael to State of Belief Radio. Welcome.
We're delighted and honored to be on the show with you and the big supporters of your institution.
Well, thank you, sir.
We're glad to hear words of praise of our book from anybody, anytime, but it particularly helps when it comes from somebody that we already have a great deal of respect for.
Well, thanks so much. Now, I started to ask as the first question, I know you're a father and son team, I started to ask which is the wiser, but instead of doing that, let me just ask which is the father and which is the son?
Well, I'm Ed Buckner. I'm the older, and he's the wiser, I'll freely admit.
Ah,
yes, this is Michael Buckner, and I don't know about that, but we each have our strengths and weaknesses in this.
I'm not surprised at that. Well, look, your book.
I think maybe one of the first things I ought to do is just comment very briefly on the subtitle of the book, because it has been misunderstood
okay.
by a few people.
All right, go to it.
It's subtitle, as you already eloquently read, is An Atheist Guide to Religious Liberty. It should be stressed that that's because it's coming from an atheist, not because it's for atheists, or not exclusively uh-huh. for atheists. We're atheists. We make no pretense to the contrary. But our book is not a pro-atheist book. It's a pro-secularism book, and that means that it's in something that's in everyone's best interest, whether they're fundamentalist Christians or atheists or more reasonable people, as they would style themselves, mm-hmm. In between.
Well, you've just opened the door to the first question that I wanted to ask anyway. Your book covers ground that we address regularly here on State of Belief, and it is indeed important ground. So I want to ask you right off to summarize from your perspective why maintaining a secular government and society is so important to atheists and to people of faith alike. Whichever one wants can begin.
Well, let's let Michael do that one since
okay.
I already blabbed.
All right.
Okay. Well, to begin with, maintaining a secular government is important to protecting everyone's freedom of religion and religious liberty of conscience. I think it's also important to note that fundamentally, having a secular government is the best way to maintain civil peace. In past times, establishment of religion and attempts to enforce uniformity were often justified in terms of maintaining national peace. But, of course, the history shows that it tends to have the opposite effect.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Dad, you want to say anything about that?
Well, I mean, I certainly agree with my son. I don't agree with him on everything in life, but I agree with him in pretty much everything in this book. And secularism is, it's in one way of putting it, is that religious decisions are too important to let the government make them.
Mm-hmm.
We don't advocate having a government that is pro-atheist or that excludes religiosity. The founding fathers of this country, and yeah, they were all guys. There weren't very many women that were allowed to speak in public in those days.
Yeah.
But the founding fathers didn't establish an anti-Christian or an anti-theistic constitution or form of government, and we don't think they should have. They established instead a government that is neutral. Now, it can't be perfectly neutral because life is never quite that perfect.
Mm-hmm.
But that should be the ideal. That should be the goal, that we keep government out of making these crucial decisions, whether our conclusion, as ours is, that there is no God and there is no religion and we're on our own, or whether the conclusion is that of theist and
right.
religionist of all sorts.
You know, I mean, both of you know that there will be people who argue about that. And you made the statement just a moment ago, Ed, and you say it very clearly in the book. Secularism is not anti-Christian. As a Christian, I believe that secularism isn't anti-Christian. But I'd like for you all to elaborate on that a bit, because so many people disagree with it.
Well, the alternative is to let the government decide what counts as a good Christian.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know why any Christian would want to put any government in charge of making such distinctions,
yeah.
whether it's good Christian or good Muslim or good whatever else it is.
Right.
If you want to protect your liberty, you don't want majorities or governments making decisions about these things or having power over you.
Mm-hmm.
You don't want toleration. You want genuine liberty.
Right.
Yeah, surely nobody wants the United States Congress to be getting involved in the most important affairs of their church, especially not these days. So.
Yeah. Well, how do you, I want to get a specific now, how do you see public policy being impacted by this mischaracterization of the United States as a Christian nation? What is the impact of that?
Michael, you want to go first?
Yeah, fundamentally, I think the impact is to use Christianity really as sort of a weapon for the imposition of various political values, many of which are pretty secular themselves and really have nothing to do with religion. I mean, you know, the New Testament especially is not all that big on wealth, but, you know, the Republican Party these days has something of a reputation as the defender of the rights of the 1%.
Mm-hmm.
So this claim that we're a Christian nation can be used to sort of bash anybody who disagrees with whatever the agenda is as being unchristian, as being, and therefore there's the second false claim that this means that these people are immoral.
And I would add to that, Michael, of course, is correct, but I would add that it is certainly been a tool used for oppression and deprivation of rights, not only of atheists, certainly we've come in for our share of that too, but also of minority religious points of view, minority within Christianity, as well as minority of other religions.
You know, I would say, in answer to the next question that I'm asking you, I want to ask you, who loses when we start to define ourselves that way? I think Christianity loses when we define ourselves that way. Who else?
Well, I think everybody does.
Yeah, I do too. Yeah. Talk about that, because I think a lot of people don't get that.
Well, it goes back to this notion of who do you think should have the power to define these terms and these ideas that are so important to you, your atheism, your Christianity, your understanding of what the Prophet Muhammad has told you, etc.
Mm-hmm.
If you want to give that power to the government or to the majority in the community, then you have to understand you're taking a huge risk, as long as you're in the majority on that particular question or on that particular religious view, then you're reasonably safe. But it's mighty fragile because these opinions change over time. And there are things that often cannot be directly addressed by evidence, and therefore they're much more subject to abuse by government has huge power. Religion has huge power, at least in emotional terms. And when you mix the two together, individuals, no matter what their religious beliefs are at great peril.
Yeah. I'm speaking.
And one thing that,
go ahead, yes.
Yeah, I was just going to say, one thing that needs to be emphasized is that if you slice the question finely enough, everybody winds up being a member of a minority one way or the other. I mean, the majority may agree with you about the existence of a God or even believing in Jesus Christ, but then when you start getting it down to the denominational level and just some things that a lot of people think are really important, all of a sudden you're going to find yourself outvoted.
Mm-hmm.
I trust that most Christians would not, change their views on, their basic religious beliefs because they got outvoted by a majority vote.
Right. That's a very good point. I'm speaking with Edward and Michael Buckner, co-authors of In Freedom We Trust, An Atheist Guide to Religious Liberty. Now, Mike and Ed, in the book, you write about how the attacks on Barack Obama's faith are nothing new in this country. In fact, you point out that Thomas Jefferson was intensely criticized by some in his time for refusing to allow more religion into the founding documents. Talk about that, please.
Well, it was more than just that he was attacked on that ground. He certainly was. He was accused of being an atheist, incorrectly, but he was accused of that for political reasons. He also had to come to terms with fairly violent attacks on the U.S. Based on religion. I mean, it was actually before he was president, but during his era that the first attacks against the U.S. That were done, at least in part, in the name of Islam, occurred off the Barbary Coast. Our seamen, and this had certainly been happening for a long time before that, our seamen, our ships were attacked, and our sailors were imprisoned and turned into slaves. Now, the people who were doing this probably had profit motives more than they did profit with a PH motive, but at least in some cases they did use Muslim, Islamic ideas as an alleged basis for this. A treaty that was agreed to before Jefferson's presidency, but during his era, treaty with Tripoli, made it very plain. It passed but unanimously in the U.S. Senate. It was agreed to in Washington's administration, but ratified after Adams became president. And it said, the government of the United States is not in any sense founded on the Christian religion. It said that to reassure the Bayan people of Tripoli that we weren't going to go to religious war with them. The treaty wasn't very effective, and in fact, once Jefferson did become president, we had a substantial war and settled it by military means, not necessarily the best thing to do, but it worked in that case.
Yeah.
So this history of religious conflict and misuse of religious ideas for political and economic purposes goes way back. It certainly goes back before the founding of this country, but throughout American history.
Michael, I want to turn to you with this observation. In light of what your dad just said, it is ironic that some conservative historical revisionists like David Barton insist that Jefferson was one of the prime advocates for a Christian nation, but really no amount of talking about the founder's original intent seems to resonate with most everyday Americans. So when you talk to people, how do you convey the importance of these issues to life in 2013?
Well, of course, it's absolutely bizarre to claim that Jefferson was an advocate of a Christian nation. He was the one who coined the whole phrase of separation of church and state, though he was certainly not the only founding father and leader of that era to talk about the importance of separating religion and government, is how Madison put it. It's also bizarre because Thomas Jefferson himself, while he was not an atheist, had views that were distinctly different from what most people think of as Christianity. He flat out stated that, while he revered Jesus as a great moral teacher, he did not believe that Jesus was born of a virgin, that Jesus was Son of God or that Jesus died for our sins.
Mm-hmm.
These ideas are even more important today than they were then, because for one thing, our country is even more diverse now than it was in Jefferson's day.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, in Jefferson's day, you had Catholics and Protestants and a few Jews, and to that we add, even more varieties of Christians. We have, Orthodox Christians from Eastern Europe now. We have Mormons. We have homegrown groups like the Mormons and Jehovah's Witnesses. And we have people from all over the world. We have Muslims. We have Hindus. We have Buddhists. We have an increasing number of people who don't profess any particular religion at all, including open atheists.
Mm-hmm.
And we all have to get along, and we all want our rights to be protected, and therefore it's all the more important to maintain that wall of separation between religion and government.
Well, it's well said, and it gets right to the heart of my concern, and I think it would be the concern of anybody that reads your good book and understands it and wants to do something about it, because it right now, it seems like that everybody feels like they're not getting a fair deal in relation to religious freedom. I mean, ironically and astonishingly to me, that there are many Christians who feel like they're under attack in this nation, which just blows my mind. But how do we move beyond everybody feeling like they're being denied what is rightfully theirs by the Constitution so that we can come together and protect each other's rights? How do we get there?
Well, it's there seems to be, we fought over it for over 200 years, so I don't suppose there's any easy path to get there. But I would say don't read David Limbaugh's book and take it very seriously on Christian persecution. and just understand how bizarre it sounds to say this is a Christian nation. The great vast majority of us are Christians. And by the way, we're persecuted by everybody else.
Yeah, yeah.
That on its face is silly. The things we're arguing about are not silly. And in fact, there has to be some understanding that you have to allow somebody to disagree with you before anybody's liberty is protected. And that's not just related to religion, but related to other matters as well. If you insist that the only way you can be happy is if everybody agrees with you on everything, you're not going to be happy.
Right.
It's just not going to happen.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
We have to find ways to peacefully disagree with each other, to have elections to decide things, but not to have wars to decide things, and
mm-hmm.
to keep religion out of the government sphere altogether.
Well, the truth is, we're not doing any better with our views about government than we are with our views about religion. We're just carefully and methodically tearing democracy apart by a kind of rabid partisanship that's about me but not about you. Let me ask you a question. We've got to go, but I just am curious to know, in dealing with these issues, so important issues, in such a fine way as you've done, I'd like each of you to tell me, are you optimistic or are you pessimistic about the direction we're going related to this issue?
Well, as the old guy, I'll go first and then we'll let youth take over. I am guardedly optimistic. I certainly don't think it's automatic or that progress is guaranteed. I honestly think that America is an exceptional nation, not because of its connections to any particular version or idea of God, but because of its invention of secularism.
Mm-hmm.
Not quite true to say that we invented it out of whole cloth, but the American government is really the first important government in the history of the world that is not based on a religious idea. And that's very important to religious people. And there are, I think the Interfaith Alliance, of course, has something to do with this. There are lots of institutions and organizations that are working hard to educate people. I'm, of course, eager to have people read our book. You don't even have to buy it. You can actually go to the library. There are lots of libraries now that have the book. But I'm guardedly optimistic. And boy, I hope my son is going to say the same thing, more or less.
Yeah, I'm definitely, fundamentally, I am optimistic. I think our, as I said, Americans are becoming more diverse in how they think about God, not less. And I think that people will realize that the only way to protect religious liberty, therefore, is to respect the belief of beliefs of others. To be optimistic is not to be complacent, of course. We all have to, you know, to work for these things. But, yeah, I think in the long run, I just don't think it's going to be demographically possible for any religious view to maintain some kind of stranglehold on political and social power in this country.
The title of the book is In Freedom We Trust, An Atheist Guide to Religious Liberty. It's just out from Prometheus Books. It's a thoughtful, carefully written, and important examination of an issue that's in the headlines a lot these days, but that's not getting anywhere near the kind of rational analysis that's provided in the pages of this new volume. The authors are the father-son team of Edward M. Buckner, retired president of American Atheists, and before that, executive director of the Council for Secular Humanism, and Michael E. Buckner, vice president of the Atlanta Free Thought Society. Gentlemen, I greatly appreciate both of you taking time to be with us today on State of Belief Radio.
We're delighted and honored to be with you and your many, many listeners, and thank you very much for allowing us an opportunity to talk.
Thanks for having us.